The surgeon bound his wounds and had him carried gently to his bed, with Rosalind hovering. The slash along his arm didn't concern him much, but his punctured kidney throbbed, and he felt sicker than ever in his life.
"The blade was poisoned, my Lord Azaltar," the surgeon told him. "I know its smell. You must drink this to counter its effects."
He held a cup to Straker's lips.
"You trust this guy?"
Straker asked Rosalind, grasping the cup himself.
"He has been the royal surgeon all his life, as was his father before him. So yes, I do," said Rosalind.
Straker drank. It tasted awful, which seemed to be a prerequisite of all medicines.
"It will make you drowsy, which is all to the good," said the doctor. "Were you not the Azaltar and possessed of supernatural strength, you would be dead now. Rest and heal."
He turned to Rosalind.
"Call for me if he worsens." "I will."
She let the man out the door. Straker saw guards in the hall, and when Rosalind returned, she locked and barred the window.
"You are safe now."
"I thought I was safe before." Rosalind blushed with shame.
"As did I. We should have no need of guards in our own house."
"Guess you're not so Machiavellian as I thought."
"What does that mean?"
"Never mind." Straker laid his head back on the pillow, feeling a heaviness steal over him. Rosalind poured a drink, this time of spiced wine that tasted much better than the medicine, and shared it with him, putting it to his lips. When he'd drunk his fill, he said,
"You think Drake was behind it?"
"Drake? No."
"He doesn't like me much."
"He's no murderer. If he wanted you dead, he would challenge you and kill you."
"Or I'd kill him."
Rosalind gave him a skeptical look. That irked Straker. Other than his Kung Ju instructors, he'd never run into anyone that could take him in a fair fight, and he found he didn't like it much. But obviously, he was bound to run across someone sometime who could. Straker's thoughts drifted, and he felt Rosalind slip into bed with him. He noticed the warmth of her skin, her thighs and breasts against him, and he realized she was naked. A surge of adrenaline fought with the drugs and the wine as she ran her hands along his chest.
"Don't,"
he mumbled, unable to fend her off. He felt himself respond to her touch.
"What did you—" "I put herbs of potency and desire in the wine,"
she said, as she threw off the blankets and straddled him.
"If I cannot have your heart, and your head refuses me, then I shall at least have your body and your seed, Derek Straker, my Azaltar."
"No, hold on."
"Worry not, my love. You will remember nothing of this in the morning."
Whether it was the drug, Rosalind's allure, or his own treasonous body, he found himself powerless to resist. Chapter 19. Straker in Kalaria. When Straker awoke to morning's light streaming in the still barred windows of his castle room, he tried to recall what happened the night before. He remembered the attack and the doctor who patched him up. And Rosalind, what had she said? Did she? Straker threw off the blankets and looked down at himself, but all he saw were bandages, and no evidence of what? He wasn't even sure. It must have been a dream. No way he would have been able to perform, even if he wanted to. Not with that sleepy drug and all these injuries. He sat up carefully and found it wasn't as bad as he'd feared. His biotech was serving him well. Swinging his legs to the floor, he stood and tottered to the privy, and then he rang the bell on a cord. Servants rushed in and helped him don loose clothing and brought him food and drink. Soon after, Gorbin entered.
"I thank the Holy One. You survived," he said.
"Holy One, I thought you weren't superstitious, you know, about gods and demons and stuff like that." Gorbin stared at Straker in astonishment.
"I'm not. The magic men and their followers believe in demons and spells and such like, but not those of the true faith. The Holy One created the land and the firmament and set all things in motion, but according to the scriptures, he seldom meddles in the affairs of men. Yet, shall I not praise him for good fortune?"
Gorbin shrugged.
"Only the most narrow-minded does not at least give thanks. Have you never addressed your own gods, even on the battlefield?"
"Maybe I have," Straker mused, thinking about placing Orset in the ground and speaking the regimental chaplain's funereal words. "Pascal's wager."
"What is that?"
"It means, if there is a, holy one, one that's benevolent, why not stay on his good side, and if not, no harm, no foul."
"Exactly." Gorbin opened the window. "But the magic men do not believe this way. They have been spreading lies that you are a demon. And now I fear you have proven them right. The poison on the blade was enough to kill 5 strong men. Yet you live."
"You think they're behind it? These magic men?"
"It is likely, but we will not soon know. The assassins died by their own poison before they could talk."
"That's convenient. Wasn't Drake in charge of the interrogation?"
"You think he silenced them?"
"I think he's the prime suspect in this whole thing."
"This I doubt. Drake is far too prudent to risk such a rash course."
Gorbin paced, staring at the floor and tapping his staff in thought.
"I do not wish to seem ungrateful, Azaltar, but perhaps you should be on your way as soon as you are well."
"Hey, that sounds great. You know a way over the wall to Glasgow? I mean, Renarog?"
"I know a way past the wall, but I know not where it goes, to Renarog or some other land. It is far from where Rosalind found you, a river that plunges beneath the barrier."
"Sounds chancy. What about just climbing over?" Gorbin glanced at the closed door and lowered his voice.
"In my heart of hearts, I do not believe Rosalind can climb the wall, though I could not say so publicly. And is not the descent on the other side just as dangerous? Did you not say that those of Glasgow seek to capture you?"
"You're right," said Straker. "Better to take a chance on the river, I guess. At least, I'll take a look."
"Excellent. I will leave you to your rest."
"Hey, Gorbin."
"Yes, Azaltar."
"What does that mean, anyway, Azaltar?"
"On the old tongue, it means..."
Gorbin searched his memory.
"Freedom bringer."
Straker choked on his wine. "Liberator?"
"That is a fair translation."
"Maybe there's something to your prophecies after all."
"Of course there is. The key to prophecy is to always leave the interpretations to the latest possible moment. It matters not which is chicken and which is egg."
Gorbin winked.
"You were the one who came to help us. Thus, you are the Azaltar."
"Call me Derek, will you? Derek Straker. That's my name."
"All right. Derek Straker. Alas, I have no other name than Gorbin."
"No problem. Hey, what I wanted to say was, could you keep Rosalind away from me?" Gorbin raised an eyebrow.
"An unusual request."
"Look, she's just,
getting a little too friendly. I already have a woman.
The woman loves the man's honor, but honors only the man's love.
Straker nodded. Yeah, she said that, but I can't quite puzzle out what it means.
It means, Derek Straker, that when it comes to love, women have indeed no honor at all.
Maybe here in Kalaria.
It is the only place I know. Are the women different in your land?
Some are. Then Straker thought of Tashina. Some aren't, I guess. Gorbin held up a hand.
I will ask the king to forbid her to come for your health. I do not know how long that shall hold. In the meantime, rest. Ring when you awake again. We must speak further. I would hear your wisdom on many matters.
Before I go away, you mean? Gorbin smiled and turned toward the door.
Until later, Azaltar.
For 3 days, Straker stayed in his room. He ate and drank. He bathed in a copper-lined tub the servants brought. He slept. And he talked at length with Gorbin. Two young scribes took notes as they spoke, and Straker poured out all he could think of on every topic that occurred to him: military science, medicine, agriculture, engineering, logistics, whatever crossed his mind. He made sketches which Gorbin preserved as if they were holy writ, and Straker supposed they were, in a way, made by the hand of the Azaltar himself. Straker also used his telescope to spy out his window, staying back from the opening when he could in order not to be seen watching. The Bortoks seemed to have withdrawn several kilometers down the valley, leaving only scouts. He caught no more glimpses of Myrmidon, though somehow he felt like the man was still watching him. On the 4th day, Drake visited, along with Gorbin. I apologize for not ferreting out who tried to have you killed, Azaltar, he said stiffly. I assure you I had nothing to do with it.
I believe you, and I apologize for missing our appointment, Straker replied. I was looking forward to your instruction with the sword.
I as well, but it is not to be.
Gorbin tells us you will leave as soon as you are fit.
That's true.
It's also true that I have no interest in Rosalind.
I know. At your word, the king has forbidden her to see you.
That was well done.
Drake cocked his head. Yet she does not seem distressed. You were a passing fancy. He held out his hand.
I have wronged you, Azaltar Straker.
Straker clasped hands with the Knight Baron.
Yes, you did, but it's forgotten.
I hope you can stay a 10-day more, at least for the joining ceremony.
Joining ceremony?
Rosalind has consented to be my mate for a year and a day, now that the first snows dust the mountain peaks and the Bortoks have fled to their warm lowlands.
Straker grinned.
Well, hell. Congratulations, Drake, my man. I hope you make each other happy.
As long as there is issue, I shall be content.
Yeah, there's always issues, aren't there?
Drake and Gorbin exchanged arch glances, and Gorbin showed Drake out, claiming Straker was tired. Straker thought the old wizard probably just wanted to keep picking his brains for knowledge. Over the next 10 days, Straker healed and began light exercise. Drake invited him to his sword hall, where he instructed the other knights and soldiers in the finer points of blade work. Straker sparred vigorously, losing himself in hard exercise. When he wasn't working out, he visited the sawmill and helped put the new trebuchets into place. In the evening, Gorbin instructed him in the high tongue, enough to recognize a few hundred words and speak simple, childish sentences,
and they talked long into each night about many things. Straker saw Rosalind at dinners with the king, and she seemed the model of decorum, attending to Drake and ignoring Straker beyond ordinary courtesies. Yet Straker always felt her watching him out of the corner of his eye. Despite the attractive, simple life these people led, he'd be happy to move on, if only to get away from the princessa. After Drake and Rosalind's joining ceremony and the inevitable feast and carousing afterward, Gorbin and Straker set out with a party of guards and woodsmen. They headed in the opposite direction from the Bortok lowlands, across the plateau, and down its reverse side, into a great forest. Rosalind had stood next to Drake atop the castle wall. With one hand, she waved a silken scarf. The other rested on her belt buckle. Something about that pose reminded him of Carla, and he felt as if a snatch of memory danced just outside his mind's eye. No matter. This chapter of his life was over. He'd done good deeds, and now it was time to claim his payment, a way out. Carlanus insisted on accompanying them. "You travel through my forests," the giant said. "I know every tree, every rock, for 100 leagues." Straker thought that might be an exaggeration, but he was happy to have the big man along. In the evenings, after the day's travels, Straker had the captain of the guards give the woodsman instruction on man-to-man axe work. "You know best how to chop down a tree," he said. "You need to learn how to best chop down a Bortok." Huntsmen scouted ahead and brought down game, fowl, large rodents, and something like deer, which they roasted over an open bonfire. With their meals, the whole group enjoyed wine mixed with cool, sweet water from the mountain streams. They slept soundly on blankets spread upon soft boughs cut from fragrant bushes. Straker found himself in the best shape of his life, with the exercise and fresh air, so different from his many years lived aboard ships and in mech suits. When they reached the wall after 9 days' travel, Straker felt a strong twinge of regret and an urge to go back with these simple people. Then he remembered Rosalind and the undercurrent of politics at Kalaria, and that feeling passed. He realized that this journey had been a vacation, a camping trip, and like all good things, it had come to an end. "So, let's take a look at this passage," Straker said. "It is here," said Gorbin, walking Straker to the river's edge, a short cliff that dropped to the surface. The flow met the wall and passed under it, moving at a furious pace. Straker looked up at the 100-meter barrier, wishing there was some way over. The ancient Romans had built an earthen ramp up to the top of Masada taller than that, but it had taken them 2 years and 15,000 people. Straker didn't have either, what he wouldn't give for a simple set of jet boots. He caught sight of movement atop the wall. Someone was looking down at him. Straker fumbled for his spyglass in the case, but by the time he got it out, the target was gone. Myrmidon again? He wished he could get his hands on the man. "Well, might as well get going," Straker said, passing the spyglass to Gorbin. "Give this back to Rosalind, please." He stepped off his chainmail and handed it to Carlanus. "Thank the king for the loan of his son's armor. It saved my life." Carlanus folded the chainmail and passed it to another, and then seized Straker in a bear hug. He pounded on Straker's back and wept. "I shall miss you, Derek Straker, my Azaltar." Straker held the giant at arm's length, looking up into his bearded face. "Your friend, Carlanus. I'm not Azaltar anymore. Gorbin tells me your scriptures say someday the Azaltar will return to you in your time of need."
"As the Holy One wills it."
"Whatever you say, big guy." Straker turned to Gorbin and held out his hand light. "I want you to have this."
Thank you, but I must refuse.
Refuse?
You may need it where you're going. It is enough that I now understand its principles. In a few years, we will make our own electricity, our own gunpowder.
And your own indoor plumbing, I hope, Straker said with a grin. He picked up the oiled leather bag he'd prepared, containing a few useful items, slung it across his back, and gave a farewell wave as he readied himself to enter the river. Suddenly, he heard a shout. Tafar, the young engineer, came running out of the woods and stumbled up to the Kalarians. He had little with him but a knife and a shoulder bag, and he looked starved. He leaned over, wheezing, trying to catch his breath.
Water!
He croaked. After taking several sips from a canteen, Tafar stood and in a voice of agony said,
Kalaria has fallen.
What?
Gorbin seized Tafar's shoulders.
Explain.
5 days ago. I have run the whole way. The Bortok made a night attack after we thought they'd all gone to the lowlands. Though we slew thousands, they came in their tens of thousands. The king is dead. Baron Drake and the Sessa fought a valiant rear guard, and many of the people fled to the high mountain pastures, but many more have been enslaved.
Kalaria is no more, said Gorbin in stunned wonder. We must return. We must fight. We will retake what is ours, said Carlanus. We cannot fight so many in open battle, said Gorbin. But we can survive in the snows, as the Bortok cannot. We will prick them 1,000 times, and they will bleed until they leave our lands, cried Carlanus.
He turned to Straker.
Azaltar, you will aid us.
Straker nodded, appalled.
Of course I will.
Tafar leaned in close to Gorbin to speak softly in his ear. Gorbin's eyes widened, and then he turned to Straker.
No, Straker, you have told me of your struggle for the stars. You must go return to the firmament and win your war in the heavens. Then you can come back to us and right this wrong.
Straker said truculently, I'll do as I damned well please, and I can't let your people down. I'll help you, Gorbin interrupted, stepping closer.
Tafar told me something.
What? Something you think will change my mind?
No, Azaltar. Something that will ensure your return to us when your appointed tasks are complete.
He stepped closer still until he towered over Straker and had to lean down to speak softly.
Roslyn carries your child.
With that, Gorbin slammed his palm into Straker's chest and sent him sailing into the river. Chapter 20 Fastlane System, 100 Worlds. The flagship Victory cast off its last connections and floated free of the Carstairs Corporation's space dock above Fastlane 2. Billingsworth M. Carstairs VI watched through the giant crystal external window that allowed him to see the spectacle with his own eyes. If he preferred ultra-definition detail, he could turn to look at several holograms projected overhead. He stood on a VIP platform, elevated 5 meters above the crowd, alongside a gaggle of admirals, ministers, members of parliament, and other dignitaries. They and the lesser attendees below applauded as the ship, shaped like a giant egg, fired its thrusters and began to move away. Within minutes, it was out of sight of the naked human eye, but the smart crystal window cleverly deformed its many layers to create a telescopic effect, allowing it to remain visible for almost an hour. Carstairs sighed. No rational man would complain about his life. But now that he stood atop the corporate mountain, the only way upward was to look for other peaks. Politics, perhaps? He could easily buy a seat in Parliament. Did he want to learn a whole new game, one where his vast wealth had influence but little real power? Something to think about. For now, he had to keep a close eye on the reports from Victory, at least until it left at the head of the home fleet. If the ship, the crew, and most importantly the AI, failed to perform as advertised, he hoped they had the decency to be destroyed in combat. Victory's radical design was a risky one. The core of the ship, the best experimental artificial intelligence ever built by the Hundred Worlds, was intermixed with over 1,000 human brains. No, scratch that. They weren't brains. If they were, Carstairs and everyone involved would be criminals. No, these almost brains were more organic computers, each in a self-contained biosupport module, or BSM. Just tissue, he told himself again. Each BSM was linked in a network using advanced brain chip technology. The tissues inside had their free wills eliminated with the excision of certain ganglial clusters and structures, but the scientists told him they still had a sort of consciousness. That consciousness was shared with the other BSMs and the machine, forming the totality of the AI. This AI had been running for over 6 months, longer than any AI before had gone without the inevitable madness. It seemed stable, self-aware, and childishly happy to fulfill its function of the perfect fleet coordinator, the ultimate expression of a commanding admiral's will. It could run ultra-fast analyses, provide advice, pass orders, and, if given the authority, it could even take direct control of other warships via the new top-secret data link. That data link was another piece of the bleeding-edge technology that enabled Victory. The first faster-than-light communication system ever developed by humans, its range maxed out at about 10 million kilometers, even under the best conditions. But even far less distance was sufficient to provide instantaneous comlinking to every ship in a task force. This meant no comlink lag. But more importantly, it meant that Victory's many unmanned drones could reach their true effectiveness. What's more, the FTL data link had no known jamming vulnerabilities. The enemy didn't even know it existed. Once they did, it should take years to research countermeasures. Carstairs had been pleased to handsomely reward the scientist who'd invented the system. She was far too plain to sleep with, but no doubt she'd have plenty of suitors now that she was rich. Odd that she'd never shown signs of brilliance before, or, according to her colleagues, not since either. But Carstairs supposed even a blind squirrel had a chance to find one fat nut. It hardly mattered. The breakthrough he'd paid millions for would make him tens of billions, perhaps hundreds. It might even win the war against the Hawk and their human traitors. A twinge of worry crossed his mind. What would happen to his Megacorp's military division if the Hundred Worlds won the war? Defense spending might drop precipitously, taking his bottom line with it. That was a worry for another day. He had plenty of civilian-focused businesses, and hell, he could always get his paid-for MPs working on starting a splendid little war on the borders with the usual false flag operation. Nothing like a threat from some scary-looking aliens to pump up profits, after all. Those radioactive Thorians, for example, were always good for a little panic. He watched the Hollows as they showed the battle module approach for docking with Victory. Within minutes, the module swallowed the rear of the half-armored ship, encasing it in the best defenses ever built by the Hundred Worlds. The module also had military-grade drives to give it better mobility than anything else its size, an extensive roster of defensive weaponry, and, of course, copious automated hangar bays
to deploy and recover the combat drones. This was the third cutting-edge development that made Victory unique. The main ship and the battle module, each at the side space transit mass limit, would travel separately and quickly link up at any destination, creating a double-sized ship. Carstairs had heard rumors of the Hawk experimenting years ago with something like this to create a super ship, but they'd apparently never made it work. However, Carstairs Corporation had, and he was proud of what he'd accomplished. A perfectly ordinary voice at his elbow interrupted his musings. "It's your big day, Bill." The voice was attached to a perfectly ordinary man, and Carstairs didn't even have to look to know who it was. It was, however, one of only a few men who could use his first name without invitation. Carstairs turned to the man and extended his hand, accompanied by a practiced smile. "And yours, Grant. None of this would have been possible without your backing." Grant Lorden, Undersecretary of Defense, gripped Carstairs' hand firmly, but not unduly so. His palm was neither dry nor moist. Somehow the handshake made Carstairs want to please this man. "I do what I can for the greater good." "As do we all." An involuntary chill ran up Carstairs' spine. Though Lorden seemed like a mere upper-level functionary and bureaucrat, everyone he knew whispered that the man wielded more power behind the scenes than anyone but the Prime Minister himself. His purview was rumored to include the Ministry of Defense's secret D Division, responsible for black ops and dirty tricks. That tidbit, added to the perfectly timed air car crash that turned the Victory program's most vocal parliamentary critic into a vegetable, was what caused Carstairs' guts to twinge with brief, unaccustomed fear. But the undersecretary was on his side now. He was sure of it. Lorden stepped closer to murmur, "Bill, you've done so well with this, despite the ethical ambiguities, that we're thinking of allowing you to bid on D-Division projects." We. The shadow within, Carstairs thought. A cabal, a group of hidden movers and shakers, it had no name. But everyone at his level had heard the whispered tales. "My associates," Lorden waved in vague directions. "Like-minded people who don't shrink from their duty to the Hundred Worlds." "I'd be honored to provide any service I can." Carstairs wondered what it took to join the cabal. Whatever it was, he'd do it. "Of course." Lorden glanced over at one of his aides and gave a nod. A moment later, two people approached. "Here are a couple of those associates now. John, Talania, this is Bill Carstairs of the Carstairs conglomerate." Carstairs turned to see a man and a woman. The man was young, with sandy blonde hair and an infectious smile, but he barely registered on Carstairs's consciousness against the magnificent creature beside him.
"Good to finally meet you, Bill. I'm John Karst," said the man in a provincial accent from one of the frontier worlds, perhaps. He held out his hand to shake. "And this is my sister, Talania."
Carstairs couldn't release the clasp fast enough in order to take Talania's hand and bring it to his lips. As he did, he ran his eyes down from her perfectly sculptured face to her ample breasts straining at an expensive, low-cut dress, to her hourglass waist and long, strong legs that ended at pedicured feet, delightfully bare atop expensive, strapless heels. His lips brushed her fingers, and a jolt of arousal raced straight for his groin. It took all of his composure not to seize her right there in a crushing embrace. Talania's lips curled in a smile that told him she knew exactly what he was thinking and liked it.
He'd never met anyone like her.
"Lovely to make your acquaintance, Bill," said Talania. "Why don't we go get a drink and leave the boring bureaucrats behind?"
She locked up his arm in hers and steered him toward a secluded alcove. He found himself powerless to resist such chemistry. Grant Lorden turned to John Karst and murmured,
"Well done. Even easier than you promised."
His security detail kept potential eavesdroppers at a discreet distance. Talania, is amazing, isn't she?
She is. Even I felt some slight attraction, and I seldom indulge in sex. It clouds the mind.
Karst winked. Can't say the same for myself. Fortunately, my sister doesn't mind this kind of work. You might say she was made for it.
Like you and me.
Lorden took a sip of his drink.
How much time do you think she can keep him enthralled?
As long as she likes. 6 months at least. Is that enough?
It should be. I want him lusting after a D-Division contract that will become a complete disaster for Carstairs Corporation. Too much money and influence in the hands of any one person is dangerous to us.
And then?
Your Talania will leave him for someone else of our choosing. Carstairs will be a wrecked man. You'll step in playing the sympathetic friend. I'll throw him a bone by steering him a cut of further ships in the Victory class, as well as AIs built for other applications. That will complete his dependence on us.
He wants in.
Everybody wants in. That's what it means to be in. Be grateful that you're in.
Karst saluted Lorden with the beer in his hand. Defecting to the Hundred Worlds was the best thing I ever did. Lorden clinked his glass to Karst's.
Defecting might be too strong a word, since you never were really part of the mutuality at all.
Karst's face whitened, though he covered it well. I don't understand. Lorden speared Karst's eyes with his own.
No need to worry, brother. We all serve the same masters. You, me, Talania, even that delightfully sociopathic fellow Lazarus you brought with you. Parliamentary intelligence is having a field day with him.
Karst shuddered and turned away.
They debriefed me, too.
I didn't realize you knew, or that you were
the same. Those like you and me are untraceable, except by inference and deduction. Obviously engineered clones like Lazarus and Talania we can explain as the product of mutuality laboratories, but we were made to be perfectly indistinguishable from those born of woman, at least to a biological test.
Then how did you know?
You and I went through the same programs, though mine were decades ago. We might even have had some of the same controllers, teachers, or field agents. I see the signs.
Let's hope nobody else does.
Any human opts who don't join us are eliminated.
Any you find?
Lorden shrugged. Some go native. Some even try to raise the alarm. It doesn't matter. We keep the nets filled with conspiracy nuts and their wild theories. Aliens among us masquerading as humans. Old hat for the last 1,000 years. And we've been careful to make everyone believe that the aliens really are trying to destroy our way of life. The Hawk. A stroke of genius, don't you think?
Yes, genius. Did you have a hand in that?
From well before my time, I'm afraid. Our natural lifespans are no greater than any others, though we do tend to stay inordinately healthy
long into our declining years. We also have access to the best transplant parts. You should easily reach 120. 150 is possible. I'm 130 myself.
I like those numbers. Karst led Lorden slowly to the rail overlooking the main floor, where those of merely ordinary privilege glanced enviously up at the VIP level. The noise of conversation and music added an extra layer of security, as did a haze of hollow blur around the two men.
"Speaking of the Hawk," Karst said, "I still don't understand how the knowledge that they were mere pawns of an enemy human government has been suppressed for so long."
"It's a difficult, coordinated, and ongoing effort. The aforementioned disinformation and fake news vids lay the groundwork. But the key is..."
Lorden tapped the back of his skull.
"I don't understand."
"That's because you're not brain-chipped."
"Other than the Hawk, the mutuality only brain-chipped certain people for brain-link to specific pieces of machinery, such as pilots and ships. Netlinks were forbidden, and shared virtualities were tightly controlled."
Lorden smiled.
"The mutuality knew the dangers of brain-chips and nets. Once one surrenders his senses to external manipulation, how can one know what is real?"
"Are you saying that you use brain chips to keep the populace under control?"
"The populace? No. They don't need such direct methods to remain sheep. They are kept happy with creature comforts and entertainments. If that doesn't suffice, layers of disinformation will lead the curious through mental mazes of our making. Those who still present difficulties are promoted."
"Promoted?"
Karst turned to Lorden with a lift of his eyebrows.
"The mutualities sent people like that to camps."
Lorden sniffed.
"Such a crude and inefficient method. No. We reserve brain chips for the best and brightest, genetically engineered brainiacs and physicals, university professors, mech suiters, pilots, those who control the media, and so on. It's a mark of status to be able to plug in and augment one's capabilities, after all. So when someone makes trouble, they are introduced to D Division. A quick weekend out of town, and they return with news of a wonderful new job, and a brain chip to go with it.
And after that, they're a model citizen."
Lorden smiled.
"Not overnight, but any interest in opposing the government or in digging up genuine secrets quickly fades. The mind is gently adjusted to conform to our desires every time they plug in. And plugging in is always a necessity for their comfortable, well-paying job. It's a perfect solution. Everyone is happier. Us, them, their friends and family, their employer, and co-workers."
Karst shuddered once more.
"Glad I'm not chipped."
"As long as you do as we desire, you won't be."
Karst swallowed and looked away, gripping the rail.
"Gods. And I thought the mutuality was a cruel master."
"Cruel?"
Lorden chuckled.
"We are the kindest of masters. Why, even our worst criminals are not imprisoned for long."
"Right. One quick implant and bang, model citizen. It only costs their free will."
"Freedom has always been an illusion, or at least a limited commodity. Only those at the top really have it. But we provide security, comfort, safety, prosperity, all the things the ordinary person wants. For those who crave adventure,
There's the military, or the exploration service. For those who want power, there's the government in public, which is allowed to operate transparently. We even provide the illusion of democracy by allowing people to select their representatives. But that government in public has almost no real power. On the contrary, Mr. Karst, like a warship, it has enormous power. It simply exerts no independent control. We act as its secret captains, aiming and directing that power. We are wise enough to know that the gentler the touch, the easier it is to remain hidden.
Karst took a deep breath. Why are you telling me this? Am I going to be whisked off to some lab and implanted? Lorden placed a hand on the younger man's shoulder. His fingertip happened to touch the bare skin at the base of Karst's neck. Certain complex molecules began traveling from Lorden's skin to Karst's.
Wouldn't dream of it, my boy. You're one of us. You have to be brought into the fold, given tasks that benefit us all, and eventually you'll move up.
Or else?
No need for threats. I'm certain you'll come around to our point of view once you have a chance to think about it.
The molecules were on their way. Within hours, Karst would join the team, and he would think he'd done it of his own free will. After all, brain chips were such crude and inefficient tools of control.
Chapter 21. Engels, Sparta System. 3 weeks after receiving Minister Benota's message, Admiral Engels arrived at the Sparta System. Her scouting force had gotten there the day before, and now Indomitable's 16 pieces joined the reduced capital contingent of her fleet, popping into flat space at wide intervals from one another. Collisions were rare, but they did happen, especially when trying to keep a fleet together. She had no need to do so, though. In fact, she wanted to present a certain ragged appearance, enough to raid Sparta, but not enough to hold it. Right now, the Huns' stealthy scout drones were already launching themselves into side space, sending initial reports into the messaging network. They would arrive at other systems, broadcast encrypted data bursts, and then rendezvous with specially equipped drone tenders to refuel. Then they would take up station while other drones carried their messages elsewhere. In this way, reports were sent efficiently from star to star, far faster than light itself. Her scouting forces, all fast corvettes, would have hunted down or driven off the enemy drone tenders by now, leaving Sparta with only the probes in place, hiding among millions of chunks of rock and ice in its comet cloud. Nothing could be done about those, but she could try to show them only what she wanted them to see. With the arrival of one quarter of her capital ships, the enemy's civilian vessels, mostly freighters and passenger liners, chose courses and ran for flat space, all in the direction of the biggest empty gap in her coverage. Exactly how she'd planned it. They were accompanied by 3 Hun frigates, enough to fend off any of the corvettes that tried to intercept, but too few to matter if they couldn't make it back to defend the planet. 6 hours later, as the convoy of fleeing prizes reached the point of no return, where they had too much velocity to turn around and retreat to the planetary defense fortresses, her escort fleet of over 100 frigates, destroyers, and light cruisers appeared in front of them, spread in a wide net at the edge of the curved space bubble. Confronted with this untenable situation, the Hun frigate commanders made the only decision possible. They instructed the civilians to heed the Republic calls for surrender, while they themselves turned and blasted for planetary return at overloaded thrust levels. Their military-grade drives held, as did their discipline. Engels could only imagine their frustration as they allowed their flock to be captured.
She added almost 20 ships and the miscellaneous supplies inside to her fleet, at no cost to herself. The passenger liners she ordered let go, after mandating that all aboard view Zaxby's presentation on the truth about the Hawk, detailing how the Hundred Worlds had lied to its citizens. Most wouldn't believe, and some would come to doubt. She placed armed prize crews aboard the cargo ships and assigned them to her small squadron of auxiliaries. Next, she moved inward with her widely spread ships, slowly gathering them into squadrons as they converged on Sparta III, the green world where stood the Carstairs Corporation's mech suit-making complex. On the way, her ships compelled the surrender of asteroid mines, fueling stations, and moon-based factories, looting some, occupying others. One monitor and four fortresses protected Sparta III, along with the usual assortment of local patrol and attack ships. As Engels had expected, there were no capital ships there. Those were all on the front lines, except for the enemy home fleet stationed in permanent reserve at the Hundred Worlds capital world of Atlantis. With any luck, that mighty home fleet, or a significant portion of it, would soon be heading for Sparta, secure in the knowledge that all they faced was a force of lighter vessels, numerous but no match for elite capital ships. In fact, Engels had deliberately delayed the arrival of all her ships above cruiser size. The home fleet would be deep inside space, unable to receive reports when most of her combat power showed up. The enemy would therefore face more than triple what they expected, plus Indomitable, which should be a surprise for only this one more battle. 3 days later, certain that the word had reached Atlantis and that the Hun home fleet must have transited for Sparta, Engels ordered Indomitable reassembled. 16 dreadnoughts became one battleship, which began firing on the orbital fortresses around Sparta III. It took only 2 hours to reduce that fortress to rubble. Without a supporting fleet and unable to hit Indomitable, which at extreme range could evade enough that even beam weapons would usually miss, the fixed defenses were helpless. They surrendered, though not before sabotaging their own weapons. The enemy monitor landed on Sparta III's moon of Leonidas, and her crew abandoned ship. Her stubborn captain threatened to self-destruct the massive vessel by detonating a nuclear warhead inside. "Be my guest," Engels had replied. Then she'd ordered Indomitable to fire one railgun shot, destroying the sitting duck's engines.
"An unfortunate waste of materiel," Marissa Nolan remarked from her position on Indomitable's bridge.
"Better than leaving it to suddenly spring into action," Engels replied.
Once the Sparta III planetary orbit was secured, though not its surface, her staff estimated the enemy home fleet should appear in about 2 days. Her newly arrived capital ships even now took their positions, readying themselves for their part in Engels's grand deception. After careful consideration, she decided against sending down what ground forces she had to loot the mech suit factory complex. She already had few enough Marines, and a stubborn defense might ruin her chances to take the critical machines and technology intact. No, better to win the fleet battle and then pillage at her leisure, using intimidation from above. If by some chance she lost in space, she could always drop a precision kinetic strike on it. The factory was, after all, a legitimate military target. That would set the enemy back a year at least, giving the Republic a chance to catch up with its own nascent mech suit program. 40 hours later, a bit early but well within the expected window, the Hundred Worlds home fleet appeared in all its pride and glory at the edge of curved space. Admiral Engels watched as the Hundred Worlds home fleet appeared as close in as possible, near the optimum emergence point. Such arrogance. But her counterpart, probably the famous commander of the home fleet, Admiral Hasten Neerdern, was an arrogant son of a bitch. He had reason to be, though. His fleet consisted of the most modern ships, with the latest upgrades. The best equipment always went to the home fleet, on the Hun side and the former Mutuality side as well. Only Engels had turned that around, leaving her older damaged ships under Ellen Gray in order to take her best deep into enemy territory. Sheer distance and the fear of the attack would preserve the new Earthen Republic, and every day she bought for the Republic meant damaged ships would be repaired and new ships would be commissioned. She hadn't tried to lay mines at the optimum emergence point. She didn't have the tens of thousands of stealth weapons it would take to cover the space. She had, however, distributed enough scout drones to get up-close, accurate readings as the enemy appeared. Some of those drones were detected and killed, of course, but the more distant ones survived to supplement Indomitable's powerful passive sensors.
"Admiral, observe," said Nolan with a hand wave that reshuffled the main hologram.
The background lighting dimmed and the display brightened until Engels felt as if the ships that hung in the air above Indomitable's bridge could be touched, like elaborate models for meticulous hobbyists.
"What the hell is that?" Engels said. "And that?"
She stared at two completely unique enemy ships. By their scale, they were of maximum size, like super dreadnoughts. But their configurations seemed completely irrational.
"I'll run the recording forward, and it will become clear," said Nolan.
She didn't bother to access a console. Clearly, Trinity was thoroughly wired into Indomitable's network. Engels had allowed this, even encouraged it, once she had confidence the triumvirate being wouldn't interfere with combat operations. The AI synthesis was worth 100 staff officers and their computers. The two strange 100-worlds ships moved toward each other on fast forward. One, shaped like a huge egg, was covered with a thick skin of armor and bristled with weaponry, but only from amidships to its slightly narrowed forward end. Its back end was nearly naked, without even fusion drives. It must be moving on impellers alone. That ragged, peeled-appearing skin reminded her of something.
"That looks like the inside of Indomitable's sections," Engels said. "The unarmored parts that slide together." "Very astute, Admiral. As you see."
Nolan stepped forward and gestured. Now, the other ship, which looked like some exotic metal serving bowl with 8 legs or perhaps like an oversized egg cup, lined itself up on the egg of the other ship. Yes, an egg was the perfect visual metaphor, as the cup ship and the egg ship fit themselves together. Now the 8 enormous legs rotated forward until they fit into slots in the combined vessel, locking the two together and leaving only 8 double-sided conformal tubes, fusion engines for sure, arrayed tightly about the ship's fat waist.
"It's a double ship," Engels said. "Sort of like Indomitable, broken in half for transit. They've made an ultra-dreadnought, or a pocket battleship. But that configuration is crazy. There doesn't seem to be any spinal weapon, and the back and the front are symmetrical, instead of having the best armor at the front toward the enemy. Sure, it has 8 engines, but they're all more vulnerable placed like that."
"Very maneuverable, though," Tixban said. "It should turn on a coin, and it never has to flip end for end. So while it's more vulnerable in general, it will never get raked like a conventional ship."
"Good point," Engels said. "What else?"
"Its defensive suite is the finest I've ever seen on a ship of its size. In fact, it has no offensive weapons at all."
"If I may continue,"
Nolan said with a hint of Zaxby-like superciliousness. Tixban muttered something in Ruxin.
"The same to you, youngling,"
Nolan said, smiling sweetly. Tixban rotated all his eyes away from her. Had he been human, Engels thought he would have put his nose in the air and sniffed. The recording continued. For a long moment, nothing seemed to happen. And then swarms of tiny craft burst forth from the launch tubes. They spread out farther and farther from the mothership, quickly departing the hologram.
"It's a drone carrier,"
said Engels in puzzled wonder. The Huns are experimenting with the drone swarm concept again. Seems like an odd coincidence when we've just come from a battle with the Opters.